portion, Genesis chapter 39 and 40. I will not read the two entire chapters, trusting that we all have read them prior to this, but we'll read a portion of them. And please remember our theme or our subject as we read along. It's the life of Joseph displayed in Egypt. Chapter 29, verse 1. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, who had brought him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight. And he served him, and he made him overseer over his house. And all that he had he put into his hand. And it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not anything he had, save the food which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly or a handsome person, and was well favored. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me," but he refused. We may go down to verse 12. And she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me," and he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out. And it came to pass when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth, that she called unto the men of her house. And then we find, too, in verse 15, that when it came to pass, when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment with me and fled and got out, and so on. And then she explains the same thing to her husband when he comes home. And in verse 20, we read that Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound. And he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in prison, and whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, and that which he did. And the Lord made it to prosper. And it came to pass after these things that the butler of the king of Egypt and his baker had offended their lord, the king in Egypt, of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with two of his officers, and against the chief of the butlers and against the chief of the bakers. And he put them in prison in the house of the captain of the guard, into the prison, the place where Joseph was bound. Verse 7. And it And he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in the prison of his Lord's house, saying, Wherefore look ye so sad today? And they said unto him, We have dreamed a dream, and there is no interpreter of it. And Joseph said unto him, Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me then, I pray you. And the chief butler told his dream to Joseph, and said to him, In my dream, behold, a vine was before me. In the vine were three branches, and it was as though it budded. And her blossoms shot forth, and the clusters thereof brought forth ripe grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, I pressed them in Pharaoh's cup, and I gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand. And Joseph said unto him, This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days, yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up thine head and restore thee unto thy place. And thou shalt deliver Pharaoh's cup into his hand after the former manner when thou wast his butler. But think of me when it shall be well with thee. And show kindness, I pray thee, unto me. Make mention of me unto Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that should put me into the dungeon. When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, he said unto Joseph, I also was in my dream, and behold, I had three white baskets on my head, and in the uppermost basket there was all manner of foods for Pharaoh, and the birds did eat them out of the basket upon my head. And Joseph answered and said, This is the interpretation thereof. Three baskets are 3 days, yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up thy head from off thee, and shall hang thee on a tree, and the birds shall eat thy flesh from off thee. And it came to pass the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast unto all his servants. And he lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants, and he restored the chief butler but unto his butlership again, and he gave the cup unto Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to him. Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgot him. May the Lord truly add his blessing to his word, and may the Spirit of our God move in our midst to take the things that we've been reading about and exemplify them and bring blessing to our souls. This morning, our brother John will give us the opening remarks, and following our brother John, we trust that possibly Tom will have something, and then the meeting is open for the Spirit of God to use whomsoever he will.
Often wondered what Joseph must have felt like as he saw the last of his brothers. He's in chains, and all his life is in ruins, and he's cut off from his home, and he can still hear their jibes and their sarcastic remarks ringing in his ears as they taunt him about his dreams. And the Spirit of God draws the veil of silence over all that. It doesn't tell us anything about the long trek across Sinai, about the crossing of the Egyptian frontier, and how they passed Joseph through the customs. And you can just imagine the kind of thing that must have happened. You see the customs official looking at the merchant men and taking a look at Joseph and saying, what you got here? And they say, well, we got one live body. I remember when I was in the British Army, when they transported a prisoner, military prisoner, from one place to the other, you always signed for one live body. And that's what you had to deliver to the other place. And I suppose as Joseph was handed across the customs, docketed and ticketed just like a piece of merchandise, customs man would say, what's the price of this thing? And they'd say, well, we've got the purchase order here, signed by a fellow by the name of Judah of Canaan, 20 pieces of silver, one live body. And the Bible doesn't tell us how Joseph felt about all this. Maybe we can imagine something of his growing wonder as this country boy from the back hills of Canaan for the first time saw something of the amazing wonder of the country to which he had been brought as a slave, the bustling, polished, spectacular life of Egypt in its prime. And the heartache in his soul is again and again he cries out to the Lord and asks the Lord, why? Why? Why did it have to happen to me? Lord, help thou mine unbelief. O God, help me to be true to you in this strange land of 1,000 gods. And then the slave market, and tagged and ticketed like a sack of grain, the auction, the bids. We're not told why it was that Potiphar, the captain of Pharaoh's guard, why he bought Pharaoh, why he bought Joseph. But he did. And Joseph entered Egypt as a slave at the age of 18. He left it at the age of 110 for glory. And for 80 of those years, he occupied the position of the greatest lord in the land next to the Pharaoh. So surely this is one of the greatest success stories in history. A man enters a country as a slave in chains, a piece of merchandise, one live body. 80 years later, he is, for 80 years of that time he spent in Egypt, the greatest and most powerful person in the kingdom. And these kind of success stories don't just happen by accident. As we look at these two chapters that we've read this morning, it seems there are three movements in these chapters. You've got a slave man, completely trusted by a prosperous master. Then you've got a successful man, continually tempted by a persistent woman. And then you've got a slandered man, carefully tested by a patient God. There are these three movements in the story of Joseph at this period of his life. And there's a key to each one of these movements. You look at that slave man, completely trusted by his prosperous master. The key to Joseph's life during this period can be summed up in two words: boundless industry. Joseph didn't waste any time bemoaning the fact he was a slave. He didn't go around wringing his hands and plotting revenge against his brothers and cursing God, as many a man would do. Joseph decided, well, I believe that all things work together for good. And God has told me that I'm going to be raised up one day to a position of tremendous power and prosperity. In the meantime, I'm a slave. I can't understand it. I don't know why it's this way. I don't know what's happened, but I believe God. And if it is God's good and acceptable and perfect will for my life that I'm to be a slave, I'll be the best slave that Egypt has ever known. And he set out to become the best slave in Egypt. He devoted himself to his master, studied his master's interests. He decided that the bonds of Potiphar were the bonds of what the Apostle Paul called in later years the bonds. He was the bond slave, not of Nero Caesar, but the bond slave of Jesus Christ. And Joseph decided he was going to be the bond slave of Jehovah and not of Potiphar. And if he was going to be a slave, then he was going to be God's slave. And he was going to give that master of his the very, very best that he had to give. And two words sum it all up: boundless industry. I suppose if you took all the principles of management that would put a man today at the very top of a giant corporation, you'd find every one of those principles of management being worked out in Joseph's life during these years in Potiphar's house. So much so that God mightily blessed Potiphar's house because of Joseph. And one can imagine Potiphar coming to Joseph one day and asking him some pointed questions and saying, "Tell me, why is it that you're the kind of person you are? I've got all kinds of slaves, Joseph, but I don't have a slave like you. What makes you different?" And so you've got a slave man completely trusted by a prosperous master, summed up in two words: boundless industry, a dedication to live for God in the most appalling circumstances. If you want a modern day illustration of it, read the book about Corrie ten Boom in Ravensbrück concentration camp, or go and see the film, and how God used these appalling years in her experience to make her one of the most influential servants of God today in her field. And so you've got this slave man. Then you've got a successful man, continually tempted by a persistent woman. You see, Joseph had all his mother's good looks. Jacob fell in love with Rachel because she was so beautiful. And Joseph inherited his mother's good looks. He inherited his father's tireless industry. But he inherited all his mother's beauty of person. And this woman couldn't leave him alone. And she set out to get him. And we don't have to have much imagination to read between the lines all the little things she did and the trick she played just to try and get Joseph all by himself. And she had one objective in mind, just one. She wanted him. A successful man continually tempted by a persistent woman. He couldn't run away. There's no place he could go. The house was only so big, and there were only so many places he could dodge this woman, 24 hours a day, when her husband was on duty. There are two words that sum up Joseph's life at this stage in his career, and if it's boundless industry that marks him as a slave, it's blessed inability that mark him as he's tempted by this wicked woman. Blessed inability. And finally, when she's got him cornered, Joseph said, "Behold, my master knows not what is with me in the house. He's committed all things to my hand. There's none greater than I in this house. He hath kept nothing back from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How can I do this great sin, this great wickedness and sin against God? How can I?" Blessed inability. He doesn't say, "I will not." He says, "I cannot. I cannot." when you contrast Joseph with his brethren and their behavior, as we said yesterday morning, one wonders where Joseph learned these things that he puts to practice in his life as an individual under most trying circumstances. Blessed inability. He might have said socially it would be very imprudent, but he says spiritually it's absolutely impossible. I cannot do this thing. That's a magnificent way to say no to temptation. Whether it's the temptation to cheat or to tell a lie or to steal or to use profane language or to indulge in impurity or to get involved in the drug culture or whatever it may be, the answer should be, I can't. Mm-hmm. It's not I won't, but I can't. I simply cannot do that. It's what we have in 1 John where the apostle writes that whatsoever is born of God doth not commit sin. I can't. And of course the woman wouldn't take no for an answer, and she persisted. She persisted in her schemes to get him. The more he drew away, the more she came on after him, until finally he had only one defense left, and that was to run away. And you know, 90% of temptation can be solved that way. Just walk away from it. If we walk into it, we can walk away from it just as easily. There are books that we don't have to pick up and read. We can just walk away from them. There are companions that we don't have to stick around. We can just walk away from them. And Joseph, during this period of his life, is marked by a blessed inability. He so knew the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob that he could not do this thing. And then you've got those last years in the prison experience, a slandered man, carefully tested by a patient God. And here again, two words sum it all up: beautiful integrity. And we won't take the time, because I'm sure others will want to get into this part of the story. But you see, faith demanded of Joseph during these years. And then you see love displayed by Joseph during these years. The love which caused him to minister to others in the prison. The chief butler and the chief baker are two that the Holy Spirit mentions, but we can be quite sure that with the keys of the prison in his hand and access to every prisoner in that wretched place of suffering, we can just imagine that Joseph displayed love, the love of God, to lost men. I've often wondered what Joseph said to the chief baker. We know what he said to the chief butler. But I've often wondered what he said to the chief baker when he had to tell him that he was going to die. 3 days from now, Pharaoh's going to take your head off. And I can just picture Joseph, can't you, when night falls, opening the prison cell of that man in his despair and loneliness and horror, and sitting down by him and telling him something about the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. Mm-hmm. So you see, faith demanded of Joseph during these years, and love displayed by Joseph during these years, and then hope deferred for Joseph during these years. The Bible says that hope deferred maketh the heart sick. It went on for something like 12 long years in that prison. And I can just imagine the fresh gleam of hope that shone in Joseph's heart as he shakes hands with the chief butler at the door of the prison and says, "Now, don't forget. Don't forget." And then he'd wait for something to happen, and nothing happened. Well, course, he's busy today. He's just getting settled back to his family, maybe tomorrow. Nothing happened. Well, I expect Pharaoh's got him pretty busy getting his affairs back in order. Maybe tomorrow. Nothing happened. Well, perhaps this week is too much to expect for him to do anything for me, but this week, maybe next week. Nothing happened. And then next month, and then next year, until finally he realized that nothing was going to happen. Hope deferred. Until Joseph had no hope left anywhere except in God. So there we have the three movements of these two chapters.
Brother Tom, do you have some revisions?
We usually think that it was about 1850 B.C. when Joseph went to Egypt. Nobody knows for sure, but we usually think it was about 1850. Working back from the date when Solomon built the temple and the fact that Israel seems to have been in Egypt about 400 years. If he went to Egypt about 1850, it was near the close of the Middle Kingdom, and Egypt was not at her prime as a nation. The Egyptians had hit their peak as a civilized country about 2400 B.C., and that was the age of the Great Pyramids. Virtually nothing great was done after that until the time of Moses and the Israelite bondage, when some of the pharaohs again turned out to be great builders, and by carving their names in other men's statues, great chiselers, we often call them. But virtually nothing was done all those years in Egypt of a new or innovative sort. And yet, because of the desert between Egypt and Babylon and the territories to the east of her, she remained quite a strong country, in fact, the only country of any considerable strength in that territory, a country that was kept strong by the deluges of the Nile and an almost guaranteed harvest year after year. In time, in our Bible account, we will find that it failed, and sometimes in antiquity it failed. But it did not fail very often. So Egypt had remained a rather strong country. The people from whom Joseph comes, the Hebrews, were largely wandering people. The very word Hebrew means one who crosses over, one who moves from this point to that point. Now, Abraham is the first man in our Bible called in Hebrew. Joseph, I think, is the second in which the name is actually used. Now, the term is well known in antiquity, however, for a wandering group of people who in our culture might very easily have been called gypsies, might very easily. They were not a national group with a country of their own ever until God gave them a country through Abraham and they would have it. And they moved from place to place in the ancient world, but they established for themselves a considerable reputation, a reputation for being good nomads and good herders and many other good things too. And so in that particular way, the Hebrew peoples developed a reputation which is not dissimilar to the reputation which the Jewish people have had throughout the long course of history. It may have been that when Potiphar saw Joseph, and I am just guessing now, but it may have been when Potiphar went to the slave market and saw Joseph, he said to himself, there is an Abiru, there's a wanderer, there's one of those traveling fellows. They looked much different than the Egyptians. It's a technical thing, I suppose, but the Egyptians were clean-shaven and often shaved their heads, too. I think it made the sun shine brighter in Egypt for that fact, but whatever the case is, they were clean-shaven. They have a totally different head structure than the Hebrews, which is another fascinating point that no one is complete without knowing. And it's one of those things. So that a Hebrew in Egypt stood out like a sore thumb. Now, Joseph was still a lad. His beard may not have grown. I didn't shave till I was 26 myself, but he may not yet have been a bearded Hebrew. He does have a beard in prison, however. He shaves it off to see Pharaoh, but he still would carry the characteristic marks of the Semites and the Hebrew people. It may have been that when Potiphar went to the slave market, Potiphar apparently has something to buy slaves with. It may well have been that when he went, he said, there's some Hebrew. They're proverbially good at taking care of things, and he may well have bought him for that account. Now, we can't, you know, we can't really guess too much, but that may well have been the situation. At any rate, as Brother John has already mentioned, it was the best buy that Potiphar ever made in the slave market. Egypt was a slave state. Historians estimate that before the Hyksos Age in Egypt, which comes about 1750, almost with the death of Joseph, before that age, they estimate that less than 10% of the people living in Egypt were free persons. Now, there's no census on that, but that's an estimate. They were slaves in all sorts of things. Many people who ran their own shops were really slaves, but they were allowed to run a business and pay the proceeds, or a large portion of it, back to their owners. It was a slave state. It was ruled by the army and by Pharaoh and by a great deal of polytheism. Almost everything in Egypt was worshipped, and almost everything was called divine. The sun by some was thought to be supreme, the crocodile by some, the bull by some. Everything almost had somebody that worshipped in Egypt. Enormously polytheistic and a place of very, very difficult circumstances. So when Joseph went to Potiphar's house, and as our brother has already said, when he was marked with this degree of blessing, no doubt to Potiphar it would have said, here's the man who knows the true God. Now, whether Potiphar placed any credence in that personally, that's another matter. But in a territory where everything is worshipped and things are just pretty much equal and going from bad to worse, success like that is bound to make somebody look twice and ask about the person who works for that particular thing. At any rate, as our brother has already said, things prospered enormously there, things prospered in the prison, and things will later prosper in Pharaoh's court. In my own mind, the great secret to that, very much like Sister Phillips has already indicated, is the fact that Joseph first served the Lord. First of all, he was the Lord's man or God's man, first of all. That stands out repeatedly in the narrative. And even in this situation of the suggested sin in Potiphar's house, Joseph does not say, I can't do it against my master, so much as he says, I can't do it against my God. It's very big with him that if he abuses Potiphar's wife, it really isn't against Potiphar so much as it is against God. So that virtually everything Joseph does, the Godward look dominates on it. Of course, we mentioned yesterday, and I personally agree with this, I think that's why he told the dreams. He knew of God's will, and since all of his conduct was prefaced on the concept that he was doing things for God or being God's man, he spoke those things because it was God's will. So just about everything that you can see in the prison situation, he speaks for God, whatever it happens to be. I'll only add this note, I think, that the Egyptian society was enormously corrupt, just enormously corrupt. One can hardly believe it today. There's plenty of literature, incidentally, well, maybe not plenty, but several volumes, that describe pre-Hyksite literature and life in Egypt. And it was enormously corrupt. For slaves to abuse the wives of masters and sometimes kill the masters was not an uncommon thing. And technically speaking, some got away with it. And a little later on, a couple of them even got to be Pharaoh in that situation. So what was suggested to Joseph by the wife of the officer was not an uncommon thing. But Joseph's attitude was an uncommon attitude because he thought in terms of God. And the thing that has always struck me, I think I heard somebody preach on it once, I don't think I thought of it myself, but the thing that's always struck me was that Joseph was mightily delivered not only because he thought first of God, but because he wasn't really looking for temptations or testings. He was not looking for Potiphar's wife. Every year we have a certain number of brothers and sisters who lose testimony and many other things through moral abuses. We discover that a lot of times, and I'm not the judge of anybody, but I just tell you flatly, we discover a lot of times that they were people who were looking for the sin, and then trying to see how strong they could show themselves in a resistance movement. But as our brother has said earlier, many problems are avoided by leaving the scene before they begin, by turning off the program, by not reading the book, by not listening to the story. Many things are stopped before they begin. And I've long been caught, sin pursued Joseph in, that is, the temptation. But he did not stand still and see how close it could get to him. And we read in the text that he would not even want to be with her. Not only would he not lie with her, he didn't want to be around her. Distance was what he sought in that situation. Well, there are so many interesting things in the chapters that I feel guilty to take that much time. But it's a fascinating age in Egyptian history, and it's a fascinating age in the life of Joseph. A great demonstration of how God blessed the man whose heart was set on God. And although I don't know how to say it exactly theologically so that it comes out right by all the tests of truth, here's a situation where God is with the man and the man is with God. And that is just simply an unbeatable kind of a partnership. That's, will hold me for a minute.
You can give me another apple sometime today for giving you that much time. I wonder now who will be the first to ask a question or to give a little more development to the things that have been opened up to us. And I do trust that you will speak out due to the tape ministry in the back. Our brother.
First of all, brother, I would like to pose a little question to our brother on the strength of verse 2 of chapter 39. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man. I wonder if a very strong Hebrew scholar, he might be able to help us this. What is the meaning of the word prosperous there? In its relation now to how we look upon prosperity today, if we had looked at Joseph's land down there, we would have thought he was prospering at all. I understand one of the old strange translations said that he was a lucky man.
Mm-hmm. Tyndale. Tyndale said God was with him in Egypt and he was a lucky fellow. He spelled lucky, L-U-C-K-Y-E. But lucky meant something different in Tyndale today than it does today. Some translations translate the word prudent, and it's the same thrust that's used with regard to the Lord's servant in Isaiah, prosperous or prudent. I don't think it means, did I interrupt you, Mr. Mack?
No.
I don't think it means prosperous in the sense of rich, but prudent, fortunate, remarkably blessed by God in his judgment and ability to conduct himself.
Wasn't prosperity in the Old Testament dispensation more concurrent with godliness as contrasted to this dispensation when many times the godly suffered persecution? I think of a cousin of mine who was discharged from a place in sales management. In the home office because he wasn't free to take visiting customers out on the town tonight. He just recently retired as a sales representative for Moody Press in Chicago. We have a man right here in Chambersburg who about a year ago was manager of the Big Nickel department store up here, Christian Fellow, but he objected to their approaching policy of staying open on Sundays, so they fired him when I was working for a Christian press here in Chambersburg, but making much less money than he made with Nichols. So, and yet, it was their godliness which led to their going backwards economically. Wasn't there a difference, say, in the two dispensations?
Worldly prosperity being connected with God. I would have
wishes you to repeat the question so that when you give an answer, it'll make sense on the tape. He won't be able to hear Duncan's remarks, but he will hear yours. So I'm sorry about that.
The question I think that is Roger has brought up is that, is there a difference as to the word prosperity in the Old Testament and in the New? Does God act differently in the Old than He does in the New?
Well, there are certainly some covenantal distinctions as far as the land is concerned, and passages like the promise of land in Deuteronomy and whatnot. There are about six or seven words for prosperity and whatnot, and this particular one suggests prudence or good judgment more than it does actually himself being rich. But in the old dispensation, a lot of men suffered for godliness too. It's hard to find anybody who had much less than Jeremiah. Just for one, Elijah didn't have much either, although Elisha did pretty well. There seems to be a providential dealing of God with His people that doesn't always make things automatic. Many of the Old Testament saints suffered greatly, and you can read about some of them in Hebrews 11, for example. Some were sawn asunder. So the physical act of prosperity was not always so automatic as some sometimes suggest. But there certainly, in my judgment, were covenantal promises with the land and with the blessing of that land and obedience to God. Now, likewise, in our age, sometimes people suffer a lack of prosperity because of godly testimony. It often happens, but sometimes they are also rewarded because of it, and they are sometimes advanced. And some believers have lost a position because they stood for the Lord Jesus, and 10 years later have looked around and realized how much better off they were, even in the circumstances of life. It sometimes goes that way. So I think that when Mr. McNeil asked about the prosperity thing in Genesis 39:2, Joseph in time would have tons of stuff. But I don't think he had much that was his own in Potiphar's house. But he had good judgment, he had the blessing of God, and in that sense, he was marked by prudence and prosperity. He had something which a great inheritance couldn't give him. He had those judgmental capacities that come to a man who trusts God and is yielded to His will.
Our brother just mentioned Jeremiah, that prophet of tears, and I was thinking, as Brother John was speaking to us, he said this: it's a good thing for a man to hope and quietly wait on the Lord. And how true this was of Joseph. I read, I think, 5 or 6 times here that the Lord was with him. The Lord was with him. And Joseph just hoped and quietly waited on the Lord. How that sustains one in a time of trial and a time of sorrow and suffering. Brother John.
I was wondering if the brother would comment in verse 3. And his master saw as Pharaoh and as Potiphar that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. I assume that this Potiphar was a man that did not know the God of Israel and his worship. And I was wondering, what was the secret of his discernment? He said he saw that the Lord was with Joseph, Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. What gave him this unique discernment?
I would assume, although it isn't said, that we've only got a fragmentary account of what went on. We don't know what took place day by day. But I would assume that there was normal conversation between Potiphar and Joseph, and I can well imagine that one day Potiphar would say something like this to Joseph. Well, look, Joseph, you're not an Egyptian. You don't pay any reverence to Egypt's gods. What kind of a god do you worship? And I can imagine, well, that Joseph would say, well, my lord, I worship Jehovah. And Potiphar would naturally say, well, who's he? Never heard of him. And it would give Joseph a very natural opportunity to tell Potiphar about the way that the living God appeared to Abraham in Ur of the Chaldees. And he would no doubt tell him something of the family history of his people, how God had appeared to his grandfather, his great-grandfather. He would say, my great-grandfather was a moon worshipper in Ur of the Chaldees when the living God appeared to him and made him certain covenant promises. And then he appeared to Isaac, and then he appeared to Jacob. And my Lord, he's also appeared to me. Mm-hmm. On two occasions. Mm-hmm. And he would have a testimony. How else would Potiphar know unless...
It may not have been noticed, and I don't really know if it needs comment or not, but you can see I've started. So in the last chapter, the sale of Joseph to Ishmaelites and Midianites occasionally bothers people. Generally speaking, all of the Abrahamic descent, not of Isaac, are called Ishmaelites. Abraham, after Sarah died, married again and had a bunch of children. Genesis 25 is it that gives us a bunch of their names. So there were quite a few. Generally speaking, all of the Abrahamic line, not of promise, whether they are from Ishmael or where, are called Ishmaelites. They're of that family. Ishmael himself had 12 tribes like Jacob did and was a very prosperous fellow too. Now, one of those other sons of Abraham was Midian or Midian. And it's generally assumed that the Midianites were a portion of the Ishmaelite group. So when we read in the previous chapter that he sold them to Ishmaelites, that means the non-Isaac Semitic body and the particular segment of them were the Midianites wandering through. They are called Ishmaelites again in this chapter, and we don't have a long historical data on that, but that seems to be the best understanding of that. Ishmael covered many things. It's like in this country, everybody who lives in Great Britain is called English. I know it's not the way it should be, but that's the way it is. I've been corrected by a lot of different brethren, and my own father would have corrected me quickly since he was a Welshman. He would have said it fast. But in this country, if you go down to Georgia, if you've got an accent anywhere from the little islands at the top to Cornwall, they'll call you English. That's just done that way. And so Ishmaelites tended to describe all those Semitic people from Abraham who were not of Isaac. And there would be about 15 or 20 different tribal groups in that body.
Could we have some comments, brother, with regard now to the temptation that befell Joseph? As this is an important New Testament principle, isn't it? As to how a man is tempted, why he's tempted, and what constitutes the temptation, etc.
Brother Phillips, I haven't called on you just lately, and you've been a little quiet since the opening remark. Give us a little bit on this temptation as it relates possibly to New Testament doctrine.
Well, there's a New Testament principle on temptation that's very important, and it says that God is faithful. And he will not suffer us to be tempted above what we are able to bear. But he will also, with the temptation, make a way of escape. And there's an important principle here that no matter what the temptation is, it's a temptation such as is common to man. God doesn't allow Satan to dream up special temptations for special individuals. Temptation is a common thing. It's such as is common to man. And this was a very common kind of a temptation. And it still is. And God's way of escape is, you can always see it coming. Doesn't matter what the temptation is, whether it's a temptation to tell a lie, or the temptation to read a dirty book, or temptation to commit something such as this woman was suggesting to Joseph. You can see it coming. And the way of escape is to get out of the way. And that's simply what Joseph did. As long as he could, he dodged around the house. He kept distance, as Brother Tom said, between himself and her. And when there was no longer any possibility of keeping distance, he simply ran away. That was his way of escape. It landed him in prison, but he kept his purity. And we don't have to give in to the temptation. There's a principle in temptation also that Joseph manifests here, is that when we're tempted, we have to give in. That's the way we're made, but we don't have to give in to the temptation. We can give in to the Lord. And that's what Joseph did. He gave in to God. It would have been quite easy for him to give in to the woman. He was a young man, he was healthy, he was normal, had all the normal feelings and passions, and he was very lonely. We can imagine how he felt, and we can just imagine some of the things that Satan said to him. He said, "Don't be a fool, fella. Why don't you take what she's offering you? What difference does it make? Everybody's doing it, and nobody knows you. I mean, you're not going to bring any disgrace on your father. And what about your brethren? They just sold you. They don't care what you do. Why don't you go ahead and do it?" I mean, there's nothing new about what Joseph went through. Everybody goes through it. If not along this particular line, along other lines, but it's not uncommon. It's such as is common to man. And there's a way of escape. The way of escape for Joseph was to keep dodging out of the woman's way. When he could no longer dodge, he just ran and left his garment in her hand. I think that's the principle.
Brother O'Neill, you may have something you're holding back, and you should...
O'Neill, brother, is an Irishman.
McNeill. McNeill.
Now, what I'm thinking special about is this. I suppose quite a number of my brothers here this morning have had to face the same issue as myself. You find some good Christians, and they reach a certain point in life and they come to you with problems, with trouble. I'm thinking of one at the moment. I always looked upon as a nice Christian gentleman in the assembly he was in, and he asked me to come aside one day and talk with him. He said, "I'm passing through an awful trouble." The man was beginning to wonder if he was saved. Or if he had been saved, he wondered if possible if he had lost his salvation. Because he was being oppressed with evil, he thought. Evil thoughts, evil desires. In other words, the man was being tempted. But what I'm thinking this morning is this, we've got to get over, even from the life of Joseph, that being tempted in itself is not a sin. It's not a sin to be tempted. It's only a sin when we yield to the temptation. Now, Joseph may have been an innocent man before the temptation, but I think we see him as a virtuous man after the temptation. If he hadn't been tempted, we would never have known anything about his virtues. His virtues only came to light after he was tempted. And according to James, if God tries us, then it's to prove our faith. And shall we say our faithfulness? But there's another form of temptation when a man is tempted by himself. Where God doesn't bring those temptations upon us. But this was a trial which brought upon Joseph that brought out his virtue. Proved him to be a virtuous man over and above the innocent man.
Beautiful.
And we may carry that too, may we not, to the temptations of the Lord Jesus. They showed the greatness of his virtue. I don't know how to say that exactly, but they were not the kind of temptations that arise of ourselves, but the temptations that showed that he was all God, that he was holy. And in Joseph's case, I think you have an illustration of that very thing. I've always been struck, though, of how quickly Potiphar believed his wife. And I've been reminded that the world is ready to believe the worst of us if it's given the least opportunity to. So we ought to be very careful in honoring the Lord not to give it any real reason, a suggested reason that's quickly believed.
I'd like to just throw this out. Joseph was accused falsely. And when one is accused falsely, how quickly we try to justify ourselves. And this, I believe, often ends up in disaster for us. The more we try to justify ourselves, seemingly the Satan can get a hold of us and make the problem far worse. How good it is for one to commit himself to him who judgeth righteously. And even the Lord Jesus, that holy, harmless, undefiled man, went out of this world under a cloud. They said he was an imposter. And even they said he was an illegitimate child. And what didn't they accuse him of? And seemingly he went out of this world under a cloud as far as the world was concerned. And yet when he was reviled, he reviled not again. And when he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him who judgeth righteously. Joseph knew time after time the Lord was with him. And how good it is to hope and quietly wait on the Lord. And for his salvation, as Tom was bringing out the other night, deliverance. If not,
Hebrews 4, verses 15 and 16. For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but which in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us come therefore boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need for us.
I've often thought in connection with Potiphar's wife, whatever must she have thought a few years later? And I can see Potiphar come home one day. He'd been just standing behind the the throne in his official position as the captain of Pharaoh's guard, and he's seen all that's just happened. And he goes home and he says, do you remember that Hebrew slave we used to have around this place? And you can just see the color coming and going in the woman's mind and in her face. And she says, well, what about it? Well, my dear, I just hope your accusations were just, because Pharaoh's just made him Grand Vizier of Egypt, and I'm to report to him tomorrow morning. And you know, Joseph didn't retaliate against that woman the same as he didn't retaliate against his brethren. No, nor against the butler either.
Brother.
Oh, are we not accountable for what the old nature does? Positionally, but not practically in many cases.
That is a complicated issue which maybe can't be resolved immediately, but I will say this too, that in discussing this temptation of Joseph, we're not talking about perfectionism in the fleshly life either. We're talking about the attitude of a believer to overt and purposeful attempts to ruin his testimony. I don't think our suggestion here is that Joseph never did anything wrong of any sort, because years later, with his father, he wants to correct his father on an idea his father has, and the father has to say, no, you're wrong this time. I know what I'm doing, and this is the way it should be done. So we're not saying that Joseph, in every setting at all times, never had any internal lapsing. We're not told of any particular, but we're not really discussing a perfectionistic thing, and I hope no one feels that. But we are discussing what happens when overt temptation is present, and which particular case one has to be responsible, at least practically. I always if I either blame the old nature or one of you, that's it.
I can see what our brother is driving at. There is such a thing as building up the first man. And people may say of that first man, Adam, that you have built up very nicely. What a wonderful Christian man he is. And it might be that he's just been a fleshly man, built up in the flesh. There'll be a man someday called the man of sin, I believe, so built up in the flesh that he'll sit in the temple of God and he'll act there as though he were God. It's only what is done, or by Christ, it's Christ in you, the hope of glory, New Testament truth. And I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. Now that's very easy to say, but is he actually living in, out, and through me? I believe I can see what our brother is driving at. He doesn't want to let the impression that we are building up man in the flesh. No flesh shall glory in his sight. Of God are ye in Christ, who has made unto you wisdom, righteousness, sanctification, and redemption. And he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. Now, I believe Joseph was glorying in the Lord. The Lord is with me. The Lord is with me. Do you not think that, brother?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that.
Yes, and I agree. I think the point here is an important one for observation. Because I think the confession is right when it said, years ago we daily sin in thought, word, and deed. But here we have an overt testing, that's an interesting study and gives us a guide for godliness and the behavior of God.
Beautiful.
Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgot him. And Dr. G. Campbell Morgan in his little book, Searchlights from the Word. If you ever get a chance to buy that little book, it's worth its weight in gold. It's out of print now, but it's one paragraph on every chapter in the Bible. And on this 40th chapter of Genesis, he picks up that phrase. Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forget him. And he adds, and his name isn't always Butler.
Well, our time has expired, and I wonder if Dave is here. Is Dave in the rear to make the announcement? Please.